Your funding for the connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. When the cost of medical malpractice insurance goes so high that doctors complain, well, we can live with that. We all have problems. But when the cost of medical malpractice forces doctors to leave your state, when the cost is so high that it's hard to find a surgeon or someone to deliver your baby, then it's everybody's problem. And in an increasing number of states across the country, that's happening. The doctors have clearly caught the attention of President Bush. He vowed to eliminate what he called excessive litigation, unfair suits against hospitals and doctors.
No one has ever been healed by a frivolous lawsuit. I urge the Congress to pass medical liability reform.
But the medical malpractice issue involves a lot of finger-pointing. Some blame bad doctors, others the bad investments of the insurance companies, others the bad judgment of patients and lawyers and juries. Connection listeners, what's the real problem with medical malpractice? Is it the greed of a litigious nation that's driving doctors to down their scalpels? Or is it the inflated financial ambitions of insurance companies? And is capping those damage awards the right fix for malpractice costs? Our number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. Now, with us on the program today, a spokesman for the doctors, a neurosurgeon from Kentucky. We'll also be hearing from a consumer advocate in Washington with a different perspective. But we're going to start with one example of what's put this issue so forcefully in the headlines, and that is that some doctors are simply calling it quits. Thomas Falaska practiced interventionist pain medicine in Pennsylvania for 16 years. Last summer, he quit. He's on the phone from his home in Erie. Hi, Dr. Falaska.
Hi, Mr. Gordon. How are you today?
I'm fine, thanks. Was it this rising premiums that caused you to pack it in?
Well, that certainly was a major factor. In Pennsylvania, we have a situation of a very low reimbursements, very low payments. We're actually 43rd in the nation. And combined with that, we have very high practice expenses, chief of which is our professional liability insurance, which is now the second highest in the nation. So the combination of the decreasing payments and increasing costs, especially increasing professional liability insurance, really caused the closure of the practice.
Now, you're not up there in the sort of stratospheric costs of the neurosurgeons and the obstetricians, but give me an example. What was your malpractice insurance premium, and what was it going up to?
Well, fortunately for me, the insurance premiums were only in the range of $20,000 to $30,000. They weren't in the range of $100,000 to $120,000 that they are for neurosurgeons and orthopedic surgeons in the area. But of course, our reimbursements in the area of interventional pain medicine are much lower than they are for a lot of other specialties.
But the cost of the premium itself, you were looking at it going up. Am I wrong?
Yes. We were looking at the premium going up about 47%, starting from about $20,000. So that would have been close to $30,000.
So you closed the practice?
Yes.
And you've what? Got a job driving a snowplow now? I gather that would be good work.
Well, not really. I mean, essentially, the situation was that I was working about 85 hours a week, and I really could not cut the practice back because expenses were two-thirds of revenue, and I would wind up having to work about 55 hours a week just in order to barely pay the bills. So cutting back wasn't an option. I had to either stay totally in or get totally out.
And the idea of imposing a cap on the pain and suffering damages, the non-economic damages in lawsuits. Is that the way to go in your view?
Well, in my opinion, I think that it's a big part of the solution to this problem, or a big part of an approach to the problem. I think that the very large awards do several things. First of all, they present a large economic drain. Secondly, they encourage a large number of lawsuits. And thirdly, they decrease the motivation to settle these lawsuits because there's a promise of obtaining more money by staying in the suit longer.
All right, Dr. Falaska, thanks for telling us about your own circumstances.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much, Mr. Gordon. It's been very nice talking to you.
Dr. Thomas Velasquez joining us on the phone from his home in Erie, Pennsylvania. Let's turn to our other two guests now. Sally Greenberg is a lawyer with the Consumers Union. She specializes in the justice system. She's joining us from a studio in Washington, D.C. Hi, Sally.
Good morning.
Dr. James Bean's also with us. He's a neurosurgeon from Lexington, Kentucky, joining us from our NPR studio in Louisville. Dr. Bean, welcome to the program.
Good morning. Thank you.
You're among those who I keep reading about as being the hardest hit as a neurosurgeon. Tell me what happened with your malpractice premium.
In the year 2000, we paid about $32,000 a year. We increased the coverage from $1 million per case, $3 million total for the year, to up to about $3 million per case, $5 million the next year, and it went up to about $40,000. In 2001. In 2002, it jumped to $99,000. So that was an enormous jump. We looked at another
insurance. With the same amount of coverage? You weren't increasing the amount of coverage?
No, we weren't increasing the amount of coverage. We dropped our coverage back, looked at another insurer, and we're currently paying about $72,000 per member. I'm in a private group with four neurosurgeons, and that's what we pay per member now.
Now, you're in a state that has no cap at all on the amount of money that I could sue you for as a patient, right?
That's correct. In the Kentucky's constitution, like many of the southern states, does not allow a cap on the amount of damages that can be awarded by a jury.
So give me an example how it would be different for you if you crossed the state line or the river into another state.
Well, Indiana is a perfect example. Right across the river from me here in Louisville, and the average premium we looked at in a survey, a typical premium was about $25,000 to $30,000 just by crossing the river. And the difference in Indiana is that Indiana has had tort reform related to medical malpractice for years. And it's been effective. It's kept the premiums down. And in fact, what happens when we look at states like Indiana, California, others that have had caps and other reforms, is the rate of rise of premiums over the years is controlled. It's stopped the sudden jumps as the awards have gone up, particularly in the last 4 years.
Now, Sally, you're listening to me talking with Dr. Falaska and Dr. Bean about the cost of the premiums that they have to pay for malpractice and about the distinctions that exist between the states that have the caps and the states that don't. Is that the end of the story? Is there more to it in your view?
Well, let me start off by saying that we agree that these doctors have, in certain states and in certain specialties, have had to endure really outrageous spikes in their premium. We're sympathetic with doctors, and we agree that doctors whose rates have gone up too high might be forced from the state. And I heard Dr. Falaska talk about his situation, although he did mention that the problems with reimbursement contributed to his decision. So that's something we can get into a little later. But our very strong belief, and I think we will get into a discussion about data here in a little bit, but our very strong belief, and I think it's backed up by the data, is that this isn't a tort problem. This is an insurance problem, and this is a problem that involves way too many medical errors. In fact, we believe that the legal system is largely irrelevant to the problem. And if I can take a minute, elaborate a bit? Let's start with insurance. There were two previous medical malpractice crises over the last two decades, and they correspond precisely to the ups and downs of the stock market. Insurance companies make most of their profits from investment income. During years of when interest rates are high, insurers compete, and they do so quite fiercely, for premium dollars. And they're looking for those dollars so that they can invest and take advantage of high returns on market investments. When investment income falls off, they respond by increasing and sometimes gouging those that they insure with high premiums. We believe that the insurance industry is gouging doctors now with ultra-high premiums that don't necessarily reflect their actual losses. Now, the Wall Street Journal last summer documented this in a very good investigative piece. The headline of that article was "Insurers' Price War Contributed to Doctors Facing Soaring Costs." That article also noted that a decade of slashing prices led to industry losses of nearly $3 billion. The New York Times has talked about this. There was an article last month that really took a very in-depth look at the issue and tried to look beyond the hype that we're hearing from representatives of the of doctors, the American Medical Association, and other spokespeople.
In a nutshell, what you're saying is that the same blow that people are seeing to their 401k, the loss of value in their investment portfolio as a result of the collapse in the market, has caused the insurance companies to lose a pile of income or value, and they're going back to the doctors and raising their premiums there for that reason. Is that a fairly good encapsulation of what you're saying?
Yeah, that's pretty much right. And this is, you know, I have to say that I went back and looked at Consumer Reports, which during the first crisis in the mid-70s reported in depth, did a three-part series on this, on medical malpractice. And it was eerie to read. It was like deja vu all over again, believe me, when you read the story in stories from the magazine in 1977, because what they do is it did was very carefully track the investments of the insurance industry and note that tort cases are really irrelevant to the problem.
Sally, I want to get Dr. Bean in on this. The sense that it is more of an insurance problem than a litigation problem, Dr. Bean.
Well, Dick, I'll be frank. I think it's just a smokescreen. Undoubtedly, the market goes up and down. But when you look at some of the statistics from the insurance industry, and I don't run an insurance company, and I can't give you expertise, but I can tell you some of the facts. St. Paul went out of the medical malpractice business after 2001 when they found they were paying out 74% more in losses than were coming in. Those losses have nothing to do with the stock market. Those are losses that are paid out in awards and judgments that have gone to the multi-million dollar level.
Can we measure that by saying we know that there are these number of extra cases and that the awards are going up at this level? Do the statistics work that way as well, Dr. Bean?
Yes, sir. Jury verdict research has shown that the average award jumped from $500,000 to $1 million over a 5-year period, 1996 to 2000. And it's on that same linear upward trend ever since then. It's not made up facts or figures. It's demonstrable. Now, it varies from state to state. The fact is, in a state that has malpractice litigation reform, those kinds of rises don't occur. These are statistics that are averaged across the country. But when you look at the states that are in terrible crisis, states like Pennsylvania and West Virginia and Florida, where I know personally a number of neurosurgeons who have no malpractice at all. Not that it wasn't unaffordable. Some of them were paying close to $200,000 for coverage of $200,000 per case and $600,000 per year. I don't see how they could stay in business. They have no insurance at all. They can't even get it. They're going what's called bare.
Let me just stop you there. We have to take a break. And Connection listeners, we're going to come back after that to look a little more deeply at the statistics and the different sides of this. And we want to hear from you. 1-800-423-8255. Trying to make some sense of the real problem with medical malpractice, because it affects everybody. 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from NPR. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. And a look at medical malpractice and the premiums and the pressures on doctors and the resulting pressures on the medical system. With us from Louisville, Kentucky, Dr. James Bean. He's a neurosurgeon who's been in private practice for 22 years, a board member of the American Association of Neurological Surgeons, has been politically active in support of medical malpractice reform. Sally Greenberg's with us from Washington. She's a senior counsel with Consumers Union. Union. It's a nonprofit consumer advocacy organization. She has a specialty in consumer rights in the justice system. And Sally, a chance to hear from you. I think that we could probably spend the rest of the hour arguing statistics, but you're saying that this is about the insurance companies. Are there also a ton of statistics to back that up as well?
Sure there are, but let's talk about the issue of caps on damages, because we believe they simply don't work, and they do something else that's actually very bad public policy, and that is they deny compensation to people with bona fide injuries. In California's case, they have one of the strictest medical malpractice laws on the books, capping damages. These laws result in taxpayers footing the bill for the medical care of victims of malpractice. Let me say a couple of things. One is that the fact of the matter is, despite the hype about us, our society being very litigious, in the medical malpractice realm, as in other realms, 7 out of 8 people, this is from a Harvard study done in 1993, 7 out of 8 people who are seriously injured by medical malpractice never bring a lawsuit. Secondly, let's talk about the argument the doctor made about caps working to keep rates down in some states, and in the states without caps, the rates are soaring. That simply isn't true. West Virginia passed caps last year. Now, rates should have gone down, right? Wrong. Insurers didn't reduce rates, and just last month, doctors staged a walkout. States with stable rates, Minnesota and Oklahoma, have no caps on non-economic damages. States that have caps on economic damages, Missouri, for example, passed so-called tort reform in 1986. They've got a medical malpractice premium crisis. Utah, Virginia, Texas, to name a few.
Okay, I'm going to get lost in trying to keep track of this. Is the idea of having some kind of national standard, which is, I think, what the president's talking about, then a bad one as well, Sally, in your view?
Because caps on damages do not bring down medical malpractice premiums, because we're
how do you deal with the contradiction that of that to what Dr. Bean's saying? He's saying, look at my situation in Kentucky. Our insurance is well over $100,000. Next door in Indiana, where they have a cap, the doctors are paying $25,000. I mean, that's
look. It's like putting a cast on an ankle when you have a broken arm. I mean, we don't deny that the doctors around the country in certain states and in certain specialties are seeing their rates soaring. But you want the right remedy. And if you cap damages, we've seen this now 3 times over the last two and a half decades. We've seen that damages, there was so-called tort reform in states all over the country as a result of the last crisis. And here we are again in crisis mode.
Okay, Dr. Bean, you're putting a cast on an ankle for a broken arm. I need to hear from you on this.
Well, indeed, I think that some of these statistics are distorted. First of all, West Virginia did institute a $1 million cap. That's far too high, and it's not going to have the effect that the president's suggestion of the $250,000 cap. Secondly, let me emphasize the cap is on non-economic damages. There is no effort, no move to limit economic damages, loss of future earnings, loss of wages, medical costs, home care costs, all those are exempt from any cap. So things that truly make a difference are not part of the cap. Another fact that has to be considered is that every time a state passes a malpractice reform, there's a delay before any effect is seen. Number one, it gets challenged in court, and some of them have been overturned. Ohio just passed its third malpractice professional liability statute after 2 prior statutes have been overturned, and it's going to go back to their Supreme Court again, and it's going to be examined again. They hope that it will hold this time. Another fact is that it's not a drop in premiums. None of us expect to see a drop in premiums with a cap. We hope to see the experience of the states that we consider stable across the union that have effective reform, which is to stop this enormous rate of rise of 50% to 100%. We surveyed neurosurgeons across the country, and we found that a third of them had experienced 50% or more rate rise in their rates over a 2-year period.
But how do you know it's not just the insurance companies putting up the rates, as Sally's suggesting? I mean,
Because
I understand the anecdotal evidence about the malpractice, but how do you know it's not an insurance issue?
Well, of course, I don't have access to their books, but I know the insurance companies that have gone out of business because they don't have enough money to cover the losses. And it's not the loss in the stock market. It's the loss that's being paid out in awards. And I know the companies that have withdrawn from the market. And one of the fears that we have is strict regulation of insurance companies in our state will cause them just to leave the state altogether rather than being able to take in enough money in premiums to pay for what's going out. Our position is a reasonable limit on non-economic damage, that so-called pain and suffering, which is not a monetary thing. Everybody's idea is different. We need a community standard to decide what is reasonable, because there is a conflict here. There's a conflict between the individual's right to unlimited damages and the community's right to have a doctor there when they need it.
All right, let's widen this out to the Connection community if we can. We're at 1-800-423-8255. Joining us now on the phone from Tallahassee, Florida, is Albert. Hi, Albert.
Good morning to everyone on the panel, and thank you so much for taking my call. I cannot speak from the medical standpoint of I'm not a doctor. I do, however, run and manage an international financial fund here in the state of Florida, and I can certainly speak from the business end. Sally, you definitely have the right idea. You're failing to mention that most of the insurance company's operating costs, as far as their day-in, day-out salaries, are paid by, quote-unquote, this year's premiums. The drop in the equity market, et cetera, has offset their fund to be able to pay malpractice awards by up to 50%. Now, when you look at most of their portfolios, most of them are very heavily invested in managed care. And since the government has now put a cap on what they will pay for a hospital room, et cetera, they've been cut short there as well. Now, if the insurance companies can continue to raise the consumer's rate with absolutely no regard as to affordability or care, and when now in the United States 14% of our GDP is based on managed care in some form or another, and to our north, here we have Canada with totally socialized medicine, and only 11% of their GDP is spent on the entire system.
Albert, are you seeing in your own business, not a medical business, as you point out, an increase in insurance premiums as well? Is that part of your the basis that you're talking
about? I'm just saying my health care insurance goes up every year.
Yeah.
And, excuse me, sir, there is absolutely no rhyme or reason for it. I'm a very healthy 45-year-old male, clean liver, so to speak, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
So when the president talks about excessive litigation and...
Oh, hooey. The excessiveness in all of this is excessive management. You know, the average Gulfstream 5 is $45 million worth of private jet. I don't see one CEO of any insurance company in the country, and excuse me, sir, I checked on St. Paul while we were online, that failed to get a multi-million dollar bonus last year. Every one of them, every major insurance company since the year 2000 when the Republicans came into office, have ordered at least one new multi-million dollar corporate jet, every one of them.
Okay, I don't want to get into aviation here. I'm finding the medical business complicated enough. But, Dr. Bean, is it possible that what we're talking about here is, yes, in fact, lawsuits may be going up, but the insurance is a big part of this story? It's not that it perhaps is not an either-or.
I think the cost of insurance is another issue altogether. And I think it muddies the water to try to compare the cost of your premiums for your health care with the premium rise for the malpractice insurance that is paid. I have to repeat myself, it's the awards that we're seeing, the kinds of demands for rewards that all doctors get that drive up the cost for this. And the problem, let me say that the problem being not uniform but limited right now to key high-risk specialties means you're going to have a fallout in those no matter how you average it across the rest of the market.
You know where I'm lost?
I think
here,
it muddies
though?
It.
I'm lost because Sally has statistics that say that their research uncovered no increase in the number of lawsuits and no increase in the average payout to people making those lawsuits. Now, I mean, do you disagree with those statistics?
Yes, I disagree with the statistic that says the average payout is not going up. That is erroneous. Now, the number of lawsuits has not risen dramatically. That's not what's driving it. It's the payout for the big winners, the multi-million dollar winners.
You mean the $10 million lawsuit, the $15 million payout? Is that what you're talking? You're not talking about $500,000 or...
No, I'm talking about the $1 million and up. Those are the ones that drive the asking price up, if you will.
Okay, Sally, let me hear
from you. And then the big ones.
Let me hear from you on this, Sally.
Right. Well, there's always a lot of talk about the $1 million lawsuits. In fact, there's been a lot of interesting research in this area. Mississippi was in the throes of a medical malpractice premium crisis. And a law professor down at Duke did an in-depth study of what actually happened in Mississippi. And by the way, he hired jury verdict research, which the doctor is relying on for a lot of his statistics. What they found is that though the American Medical Association and the insurance industry said that there had been in the last 6 months or something along those lines, five awards over $1 million. In fact, what he found is in 6 years or 7 years' time, there were 13 cases of medical malpractice awards over $1 million, and that's less than two a year. And then he described each of these cases. And let me say something about juries sitting in these cases. He also spent some time looking at how juries arrive at their awards. These were egregious, terrible, grievous injuries to patients through medical malpractice. And juries are actually, despite what the public is led to believe by a lot of spinmeisters and who argue that litigation is out of control, in fact, juries are very thoughtful. And they're very skeptical of medical malpractice claims. And so the jury came in with awards in the $1.3 million range, and sometimes for non-economic damages. The doctor's absolutely right. Non-economic damages are the issue that the president's talking about capping. Non-economic damages are actually very important for particularly women, children, the elderly, and those that don't have an income and will not have economic damages. And they compensate things like loss of a child, loss of a limb, loss of eyesight that result from medical malpractice. We have to look beyond, as I said earlier, they have to look beyond the hype about arguing that every lawsuit is frivolous somehow.
All right, Sally, let me go back to the calls if I can. Ian's on the line now from Davenport, Iowa. Hi, Ian.
Yes, good morning. Very interesting discussion and a big problem down the road for us baby boomers as we age. And I just want to suggest that the root of the problem, unlike all this other discussion, which is very interesting and is ancillary or peripheral to the major issue is people who will allow a frivolous lawsuit, and I mean the attorneys who take them on contingency because they sense deep pockets in the form of lawyers, I mean in the form of doctors, and the people will proceed with a case that is not of great merit because they know they're going to settle.
Who are you blaming here, Ian? You're talking about the patients, the people who think they can make a buck here, or the lawyers who are taking the case?
It's the attitude of the patient that, hey, I've got a case now, and so I know if I hold on to this case, I'll get something. And it's the attorneys who offer to take these cases on contingency, knowing full well that they're not a really good case because they know that through the changes in the laws between contributory negligence and comparative negligence and joint and several liability and all these kinds of changes that have occurred in what used to be common sense law in our country, so that someone who is remotely connected, the guy that delivered the surgical instrument, gets sued as well.
Right.
So the cost of litigation, the cost of defending a litigation, even if it's a piece of crap, as the lawyers call it, is so high, and the chance of a lawyer successfully making a case in a jury and getting a sympathetic jury and getting punitive damages, you end up where everybody settles. Very few cases that are filed ever go to trial.
All right, Ian, let me ask Sally if she's going to stand up for the lawyers here, Sally.
Well, it's not a question of standing up for the lawyers. I mean, we're on the side of the consumer here and the injured patient.
At the Consumers Union. I'm just asking you.
Yeah, at the Consumers Union. The fact is that the system does a pretty good job of weeding out frivolous cases. And the conventional wisdom is that if you don't have damages over $100,000 and if you don't have a serious case, you won't find a lawyer to take your case because lawyers, as the gentleman said, they have to front the bill.
Okay, but that supports James Bean's argument that I'm going to shoot for $12 million and call it non-economic damages and see if I can get something out of it.
But you're not going to get $12 million if you don't have a good case. You're not going to. In fact, many, you know, the doctors are fond of saying that they win 70% of the cases, and that's true. They're fond of saying that's because these cases are frivolous. What happens is the system is, and we're not saying the system doesn't have problems, and we can get into that a little later because we've got some ideas there. But the system is actually very efficient in getting rid of frivolous cases and getting rid of cases that are not likely to be winners because it's just too darn expensive.
Okay, let me hear briefly from Dr. Bean on that, whether or not you think they're moved off the table the way Sally's describing.
No, I don't think so. 70% of cases that are filed get dropped because they have no merit, but that doesn't mean there's no expense in trying to defend them. The average cost of defense to the insurer is up to $24,000 per case. This is just paid
even
out
among those 70 that are dropped and dismissed?
That have to be defended. You have to go through all the research, get all the experts, and all the attorney's time that is paid for just for these to be dropped. Then the next 30%, it turns out that in the end, the judgment against doctors is in about 1.5% or 2%, and all the rest just turn out to go away, but they don't go away without cost.
Well, is it the case where a doctor, an insurance company, or a hospital says, you know what, we're going to offer you $10,000, $20,000 to just drop this right now? So there is that part of a cost?
There is that part of the cost, and I can tell you that that plays a large role. Doctors will settle rather than many instances going through the headache, the exposure, and all the problems of a lawsuit. But I'm telling you, I don't do that now, and I don't believe that's the right thing. And that's another problem. People won't get compensated when they should be if we can't reform the system to find the ones that need it and eliminate the ones that don't.
All right, Connection listeners, our number is 1-800-423-8255. Who needs this kind of help? Who doesn't? And are people getting it who shouldn't be getting it? I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
Funding for The Connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
You're listening to The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. Our number is 1-800-423-TALK, and this hour, talk about medical malpractice, what the real causes are behind medical malpractice, and what the proper solutions could be. With me on the program, I have Dr. James Bean. He's a neurosurgeon from Lexington, Kentucky, and Sally Greenberg's with the Consumers Union joining us from Washington. We're going to go back to the phones, to Burlington now, and Jerry's joining us. Hi, Jerry.
How are you?
Fine. Thanks for calling.
I haven't, you know, it took about 3/4 of an hour before you people started talking about Sally alone started talking about the damages inflicted on people. And I really blame doctors' groups for not going after the doctors who are known, you know, they moved to another state, they're known to cause all kinds of havoc. But I want to tell you a personal experience I know. My stepfather was a GP, and toward the end of his career, he started doing exclusively vasectomies. And my mother told me that a colleague of his in Pennsylvania was, I guess, an old guy or something like that, or just an incompetent or a drunk. I don't know what he was. But he castrated a guy. Now, how much damages do you want to limit? You know, it's not a question of frivolity. You know, I'm sure the insurance companies are no good. I've had to deal with them myself. We all know that. But there's something that the doctors are doing wrong. And I'm not saying all doctors, of course. Mm-hmm. But the good doctors should not be defending the incompetent doctors.
Dr. Bean, there are some bad apples in the barrel, and Jerry's pointing straight to that.
Right. And I don't deny that There's nowhere we look around our community, our society, that there aren't such. But the problem is we don't want to drive the good doctors out of the community by having awards that are so high that it drives their premiums up. When someone else has an award that's sky high, my premium goes up and every other doctor's goes up because it has to cover it. And
but we're not talking about a frivolous case here, right? I mean, that's the other side of the slope here, that the president's talking about limiting frivolous cases, and I'm not sure that there anybody on the program today is going to, you know, argue against being frivolous with this system and our health care. But what about those cases, and Sally talked about them, where maybe a $250,000 cap on non-economic damages just doesn't cover it?
Well, that's what the community has to decide. What is the value of some form of so-called pain and suffering, and balance that against the need to have doctors in the community? It's a simple equation of how much can they keep paying out? We do not want people who have been damaged not to be compensated for it. In fact, we think they're much better systems, dispute resolution systems, that can get it done in less than the 4 years or so that it takes to do it with our current system, one that is so random that some who don't deserve it get it and many who do don't. The system is wrong, and it needs to be reformed so that those who are damaged can be recognized rapidly and a sensible and reasonable compensation provided. We're all for that.
Sally, there's a system in Massachusetts where there's a $500,000 cap on non-economic damages, but there are some clauses that follow that there are exceptions for proof of substantial disfigurement, permanent loss or impairment. Is that a way of making the caps work in controlling the costs the way Dr. Beam's talking, but also allowing for the cases that really deserve some kind of compensation over $250,000.
Well, we're open to creative solutions. I think caps are sort of defy the whole notion of having your case heard by a jury of your peers that decides how serious the damages are.
Right.
I haven't looked closely at the Massachusetts law, but I think from what we know and some of the good research that's been done, juries take these cases very seriously. A lot of bad cases get weeded out, as we've said already.
Right.
Let me just say, the doctor keeps talking about sky-high cases. The fact of the matter is, over the last decade, that the average of all claims was about $27,000. Further, he keeps talking about this, you know, our litigation being out of control. The National Association of Insurance Commissioners, what they have tracked is the number of medical malpractice cases over the last decade, and even over the last 5 years, the number of cases brought has actually gone down. There were 90,000 cases brought in 1995. There were 84,000 cases brought in year 2000. So we're not looking at a litigation explosion.
But Dr. Beam also says it's those two or three, you know, multi-million-dollar cases that raise the bar. It doesn't matter whether it happens in Colorado; it raises the bar in Georgia. Are you saying that he's wrong about that?
Well, there are undoubtedly some multi-million-dollar cases, but you have to look. You got to look at the facts of the case. You've got to look at what the jury heard. And in each of the cases I've read about and I've looked at, and I can cite you some cases from California actually, because they've got this very tough cap. There are grievous errors inflicted on patients through malpractice. We have not talked about the sort of epidemic we've got of medical errors in this country, with somewhere between 44,000 to 98,000 people, if you accept the findings of the Institute of Medicine's report, dying each year because of medical errors.
We've actually got somebody who's joining us from Raleigh, North Carolina, on that point, Sally. So let's hear for a minute, if we can, from Peter. Hi, Peter.
Good morning.
Thanks for calling.
My pleasure, and I'm kind of rejoicing to be able to talk to you because I think I can contribute something. Excuse me if I'm a little incoherent, kind of aged.
I have that problem on Friday of every week, Peter. You go ahead.
Anyway, I think to be kind about it, the medical associations are major part of the problem, and the reason that they're the biggest part of the problem is because they, too, are kind-hearted. If you self-insure, you can select. After all, the whole point is to be able to indemnify loss, which is very, very reasonable. If you self-insure and the medical associations are individually able to review all these cases, sooner or later, you're going to find a certain kind of tiny group of individuals. To be frank about it, I think they're the prime cause for the entire problem. These are people who have personal problems. Many of them are addicted to drugs. Some of them, frankly, are neurologically disabled. I don't know how you'd put it. But I came across them when I designed this program I was talking about. And how do you deal with them? Well, you deal with them just as you do in any situation, that you deal with them by disciplining them. And when the medical associations shrug their shoulders and say, well, I can't really discipline this dear friend of mine who happens to have a problem, they're shrugging their shoulders at enormous amounts of money it's going to cost them.
All right, but Peter, what we're talking about here, what you're saying is that if each doctor then has to go after his or her own insurance, then it's their own record that stands. You don't have other doctors within an association kind of helping someone along. Let me ask Dr. Bean if Peter's onto something here that would actually help get rid of bad doctors within the system.
I don't think that the medical malpractice system gets rid of bad doctors. I think it has a very difficult time affecting or finding bad doctors. The average lawsuit, or neurosurgeons have an average now of about one lawsuit every 2 years.
Average doctor has that?
No, neurosurgeons. The figures now show that there's an average of one lawsuit about every 2 years for neurosurgeons. If this is a measure of being a bad doctor, then there is virtually no neurosurgeon in the country who's good enough to do the job. Now, that's ludicrous. It's not a measure. The disciplining of doctors is done through the state boards of medical licensure because they have the authority and the indemnity to be able to do it without lawsuit. The medical associations actually have a very difficult time disciplining because they are sued virtually every time that happens. They're not capable. But the state boards of medical licensure do have the oversight. They do look at doctors, and you see licenses being taken away all the time when those doctors are found.
Let's go back to the calls now. Peter, thanks for that. To Richmond, Virginia. Now Kevin's with us. Hi, Kevin.
Yes.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm calling because I'm listening to this story. I'm a family physician in just outside of Richmond in Midlothian, Virginia. And besides the lawsuit, the impact, I think, on the practicing physicians goes far beyond the monetary impact. This is the first time just recently that my office and my partners have been involved or named in a lawsuit in 18 years. And it was with a family that, you know, we were very, very close to. And except for being their family physicians, for instance, the gentleman who the patient has raised the lawsuit, he hadn't been in our office for a year and a half except for a flu shot. And when he was admitted to the hospital, he was severely ill. He was in the ICU for 2 months. And
Kevin, I need you to bring this to the point you wanted to make, that too many people are hit by by a lawsuit?
I think there's a lot of doctors that are caught in the net of the lawsuit that have no business being there. And even if it's, as Sally had mentioned, the frivolous ones are kind of weeded out, I'm sure after a tremendous amount of expense, you know, for the rest of the time that I'm in practice and my partners are in practice, we got to check that box saying, have you been named in a lawsuit? And then give the summation as to what happened in that lawsuit. And it just gets you, you know, right in the pit of your stomach every time you think about it, because you shouldn't have been there in the first place.
All right, Kevin, let me ask Sally in on this. Sally.
Yeah, well, you know, I'm sympathetic to what he's saying. The fact is that many doctors never get sued for medical malpractice. I actually grew up in a doctor's household. My father was a doctor, has been a practicing physician for 50 years. He did get named once in a lawsuit, and after they took his deposition, they decided there was no malpractice. But, you know, it's part of being in the business. The business is very rewarding, I think, for many physicians, and you're going to have to, you know, from time to time, perhaps, although many doctors never do in their during their careers, be named in a lawsuit or charged with committing malpractice. But what you find is that the bad case is a washout. Sure, you know, it creates grief for them, but the system, I think, does a good job of clearing out those cases that don't have merit. Let me just can I pick up on this point of doctors in malpractice? The statistics that we've seen suggest that 5% of the doctors commit over 50% of the malpractice. The fact is that the medical profession and these state boards, the disciplining boards, do a really pretty poor job of disciplining doctors, and they don't even if a doctor has several malpractice claims against them, what we've seen is that only somewhere around the 13% range of doctors with more than 5 medical malpractice payouts against them have been disciplined by these boards. So let's go back to the notion that the way to deal with malpractice and malpractice premiums and malpractice lawsuits is to deal with malpractice. If we weeded out a number of those very incompetent physicians, and most physicians do not fall into that category, I think doctors would be going a long way to reducing their exposure to malpractice suits.
Dr. Bean?
I don't see how weeding out bad doctors in Kentucky is going to stop my malpractice exposure. Those come from the patients that I treat. They come from the patients that my partners treat. And a doctor who's in Paducah, Kentucky, if he's weeded out, has nothing to do with what's going to happen to my premium.
Well, unless there's a lot of suits against him, and those suits go to raising the premiums, no?
Well, that's true. In effect, it's still the same problem of raising the lottery kind of mentality that if you strike often enough, you're going to strike it rich one time. And this is something that has to stop. That's what's driving it.
It also, though, sounds to me, though, that if you were to add together, a review of state boards and medical associations and in addressing bad doctors and taking a look at the insurance companies and at litigation, you'd be somewhere toward solving the problem.
You'd be somewhere toward eliminating those that are responsible for many instances. And I encourage it. I think our boards should be looked at, and they should be try to do a better job. I want to just recur to the last speaker, though, and you've got to recognize the psychological harm that it does to doctors. Just having a frivolous lawsuit and eliminated because it had no merit does leave a deep and lasting mark in every doctor it happens to.
Well, we have so much more to talk about, and we're out of time. So I'll thank you, Dr. James Bean, for being with us.
You're welcome. Thank you very much.
Neurosurgeon, longtime political activist for malpractice reform. Sally Greenberg, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you, Dick.
Sally's a lawyer with Consumers Union in Washington. Earlier in the program, we talked with Dr. Thomas Velasca. He's a physician, or was a physician, practicing in Pennsylvania. He quit this past summer, in part because of the costs of malpractice insurance. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
Funding for The Connection is made possible by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. To purchase cassettes and CDs of The Connection, please visit www.theconnection.org or phone 1-800-909-9287.